Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Chet Amud Aleph by the two dots. The Gemara is quoting from the Mishnah that Mechayev Va'of, with regards to those, it's clear a Chovel Ben is Chayav because they definitely have skin. And if they have skin, then someone who injures them or wounds them and you have a pooling of the blood there, then that for sure is Chovel B'Shabbat and be problematic. Now the Gemara uses that as a platform to understand that Chayot and Ofot then have skin and has implications in other places in Halacha. And that's what Rav Huna says. Rav Huna Kotvin Tfilin be or shall of tohor. You can write fill-in on the skin of a fowl as long as it is a kosher species of fowl. Amar Rav Yosef, my kamash malon, did lay or? What is he telling us that we didn't know already, that birds have skin? Tanina, that's our Mishnah, Chovel ben Chayav. So we know for sure that they have skin. If they have skin, then why can't they be used for fill-in? Amale Abaye, so a student Abaye says, them tuva kamash malon. He's teaching us a lot of information here. Dime matanitin, if we just had our Mishnah, hava mina came into itbe nikve nikve, we would have thought because it has lots of holes in it, meaning that after you've plucked the feathers away from the skin, it leaves behind all of these piercings in the skin, and therefore would not be good to be used for tefillin. Kamash malon, Rav Huna comes to teach us that you can still use it for tefillin despite all the holes in the skin, because the Amri Me'arava, like they say in Eretz Yisrael, kol nekev shadyo overet alav, any hole where, when you write and the ink covers it up, ain't no nekev, that's not considered to be a nekev. The problem with the nekev, or problem with the hole in the hide, is that then it causes a break in the letter. And a letter has to be what's called mukaf gvil. It has to have clear cloth all the way around the letter. And the letter itself needs to be whole, structurally whole, without any breaks in it. What happens is if you have a hole, it usually causes a crack or a break in the letter. And then you don't have the tzurat ta'ot. So in general, that would be a problem if the hole is big enough. If the hole is small, this is true by hides, and it's going to be true here by the skin of the birds as well, which is that the holes are small enough by which if you move the quill over those holes, the ink will fill the holes and the letter will be continuous, then that's not a problem anymore. And that's what the Kamash Malan is, that here, even though there are holes in the skin from plucking out all the feathers, nevertheless, it's still considered to be a good skin for writing filling on, because when you go over those holes, they'll be filled with ink and then you'll get the complete letters that you need for the Ketiva Tama. Because it says, and that makes a ktivat tama, that you need to have a full and structured writing that is complete. The letter has no breaks in it, and there are no problems with the letter. So you thought that might be a failure because of all the holes in the skin. Kamash malon, that it's not. Meitevei Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira says, Biknafav lachshir et ha'or. We have the pasuk that is written by the Korban Olat Ha'of. And it says there that v'shisa uto biknafav, that you will grab it by its wings and tear it apart, v'lo yavdil, but not completely separate it. And then you put it on the mizbech. So here, v'sakadatcha orhu, if it is considered to be skin, heche merabi leikra, then why would the pasuk include it to go on the mizbech? The assumption being that there'd be some parallel between the birds, the bnei yonah, and the torim that go on the mizbech, and the animals that go on the mizbech. When it comes to an animal, an olah goes on the mizbech, but the hide is given to the kohanim. The hide doesn't go on the mizbech. So here too, why would you think that the skin of the bird should go on the mizbech? The fact that the Torah tells you to put the skin of the bird onto the mizbech seems to imply that it is not classified as skin, because the paradigm that we're using by animals indicates that you don't need to put the skin on the mizbech, it goes to the kohanim. Now, the truth is that this question is not just really on Rav Huna, because Rav Huna just said that the or of the oaf can be used for tefillin, saying that the skin of fowl is considered to be skin. But the Mishnah says the same thing, that skin of birds is considered to be skin as well. So the question really should be equally problematic for the Mishnah as it is for Rav Huna. So the Maharsha over here suggests that if it were just for the Mishnah, we would assume that the skin of the birds goes on the mizbeach, because the skin of the birds is not a hole. It has these punctures, these holes in it when you remove the feathers from it. So it's not something of significance that you would give to the Kohanim, and that's why you would put it on the mizbeach. But now that Rav Huna says it is considered to be significant enough that we allow you to write tefillin with it, then that already indicates that the holes are not a problem, and it's considered to be an entity. If it's a separate entity, why then does it not have the same din as the hides of the animals? So Amalei Abaye, or who? Rachman or Abaye? The simple answer that Abaye gives is, yes, it is considered to be skin, but the Torah says that you still put the skin on the mizbeach. And as the Balei HaTosafot point out, that's not only thing that goes on the Mizbeach. When it comes to the Olat Ha'Of, the Pasuk before says the only thing you remove from the Olat Ha'Of is Ve'esiret Murat Ha'Of Ve'notzata V'shlichota Itzla Mizbeach Kedmal Mekom Adoshen. The only thing you take out is the digestive tract of the animal. That means that the feathers themselves also go on the Mizbeach, and all the other parts of the bird go on the Mizbeach. So why is it a surprise that the Or goes on the Mizbeach? So Tosafot says that by the animal we also have a paradigm like that as well, which is that certain parts of the animal, like the hair and the horns and other pieces of the animal, go on the Mizbeach when they're brought together with a particular Aver limb of the animal, including the head of the animal, or certain times we leave on the hair or the wool of the animal because it's attached to something. So you see that the Torah doesn't reject that type of offering, and so too over here, the feathers would not be rejected. On the other hand, when it comes to the Or, there the Torah specifies by animals that you have to do hefshet, that you have to do a flaying of the animal to take the Or off. And over here too, you should have done that flaying to take it off. The Gemara's answer, or Abaye's answer, is very simple. Yes, it is Or. Yes, it's considered to be a separate entity, but the Torah says, with regards to birds, that goes on the Mizbeach, and there is no question. Igadamre, another version of this is, Amrab Zera Afanan Nami Tanina, Rabbi Zera, rather than challenging Rav Huna, brings support to Rav Huna's position because of this Braita, Tanina Bechnafav, there are both Eto Or, that the Knafav include the Or, meaning that the skin of the birds goes on the Mizbeach. Yamart Bishlama Oru, if it's considered to be skin, Hainu de Itzrich Radi Ribuye. That's why you need a Pasuk to include it, because you wouldn't have automatically assumed it goes on the Mizbeach, because hides don't go on the Mizbeach. Skin is separate from the Basar. So you would have thought maybe that part of the bird shouldn't go on the Mizbeach. El Yamart Lav Oru, if you thought that the skin was just part and parcel of the Basar, of the flesh of the bird, why do you need a pasuk to come in and include it? So Abaye here again says that you might have thought otherwise. Maybe it isn't considered to be skin. And you still need the pasuk to tell you to put it on the mizbeach, even though then it would be one with the basar, because since it has in it all these punctures, it's the same thing as we saw before with regards to the tefillin of nikveh, pirtzeh, meaning that it's not something that is whole or shalem. It is something that's perforated all over because of the feathers that stick in it. Mice, it's something that isn't appropriate or disgusting to put on the mizbeach, and therefore you would have thought that it shouldn't go on the mizbeach, kamash malan, that you do put it on the mizbeach. So you can't bring either a question or a proof from the braita with regards to the olat ha'of, but Rav Huna's position still stands, which is that you can write tefillin on the Or Shel Of, because Or Shel Of is classified as Or, and it's classified as skin or a hide. That's sufficient grounds to write tefillin on such an item, because the Mishnah tells us that a Or of an Of is classified as Or, as a skin or a hide, that then would qualify it for having tefillin written on it. And we saw before as to why that's a chiddush, despite the perforations that you're able to write on it. Now let's extend this to another step. We know that you can do it on a behema, a chaya, or an oaf tahor. Now you can write tefillin. What about a dog tahor? What about kosher fish? Is the skin of a fish sufficiently classified as skin for in order to be used for writing tefillin on? So when Eliyahu HaNavi comes, he'll tell us what it is. So Gemara says, what does this have to do with Eliyahu HaNavi coming? As Rashi notes over here, because Heter V'Isur Ain't Taluy Bo. When it comes to making decisions about whether something is mutar, whether something is asur, tameh, tahor, all of these things are not subject to the rulings of Eliyahu HaNavi, because lo b'shamayim hi. It's not up to the heavens to make those types of decisions. Those decisions, the Torah Shebaal Peh was relegated to the Chachamim and the Mesorah, and therefore those decisions have to be made here. And whatever the decision is, that is the binding halacha, and Eliyahu HaNavi is not going to come and change that, both from the perspective of Lo B'Shamayim, as well as from the perspective of a Navi Rashai L'Chadesh Davar. A Navi can't come along and bring us any new halacha or any new law. The law develops the way it does through the Mesorah. So that can't be what Eliyahu HaNavi is coming. Ilema. So Mayimi of Eliyahu V'Yomar, what is he going to come and say? Ilema, if you're going to tell me he's going to come and tell us factual information, which is something that Eliyahu HaNavi could do, Ilema Deitle Or, Uydeleitle Or, maybe it has a skin or doesn't have a skin, Hachazinan Deitle Or. That's not a question. That's not something we need Eliyahu HaNavi to help us as to whether fish have skin or not. We know there is fish skin. That's obvious. That's not something that he's going to tell us that we don't know already. Vod, Hatnan. And also we have a Mishnah in Kelim that says, Atzamot Hadag Ve'oro. when it comes to the bones of a fish and the skin of a fish, matzilim b'olamet. They are protective. They are able to stop tuma in olamet. The basic principle is something that is mikabel tuma, something that can become tuma, eno chutzeitz b'fnei tuma, doesn't stop tuma from spreading. On the other hand, something that is not mikabel tuma, it itself can stop tuma from spreading. So one of those classic examples is a kli cheres that is covered with samid patil. It's totally sealed on the top. Tuma in a house can't reach that because a kli cheres only accepts tuma from its internal side, not from its external side. And since the only thing that exposed in this house that has tumat amet in it, has tumat oil in it, is the outer side of the kli cheres, it protects whatever is inside of it. But that depends on the fact that the kli cheres, which only accepts tuma internally, not externally, as well as that there's a seal or a cover on it. And so one of those items that is protective or can shield against tuma are the bones of a dog and the skin of a dog. That is as opposed to other animals, because we have a ribui in the pasuk that anything that's mikol maseh izim, anything that comes from the goats, is included to be mekabel tumah. And that includes kli etzem, things that are made out of the bones of the animals, as well as from the horns, the hooves, all the different parts of the animal. But there's a miut there that says it only applies to land animals, it does not apply to dagim. But given all that, what we do see from there is that the Mishnah clearly considers the skin of the dog to be something that is of significance, because it delineates it separately and says skin of the dog. So it happens to be there that's protective and it helps with tara. But it just shows you that we know there is skin to a dog. Ella, so what is Elio and Navi coming to help us with? So zuma, when it's spoken about in the physical world, means something that is smelly, something that's malodorous. So that could be the one question. Is the disgusting, malodorous side of it disappear? And the Ran brings that those are explained. That means that before you tan or you process the skin of the fish, does that bad smell that's associated with the fish disappear already from all the oils and all the things that are in the skin? And therefore, when you process it, it's considered to be a good hide. Or does that zuhama, does that stay? That would be if you're speaking about physical items. There's also a metaphysical zuhama, which means something where there was a problem that caused some sort of tuma or metaphysical problem in the individual. And the Ran then quotes, based on that idea, that which the Gemara tells us that the Nachash Baal Chava in Gan Eden and caused her to have zuhama, which was removed at Har Sinai. And the question is, whose zuma was removed at Har Sinai? Does it only include the human beings that stood at Har Sinai and all the animals that were a part of parcel or witness to the Har Sinai? But dagim that are in the yam were not included, or maybe they were included, but that would be something very metaphysical. The Sfat Emet takes a somewhat middle position here, which is that maybe by behemot, chayot, and ofot that require shechita, maybe that in itself is male the kedusha of the animal and elevates it and takes away the zuhama, whatever negative metaphysical traits you have there. As a fish, which doesn't have any spiritual, religious process that's done to it in order to prepare it to be food, maybe that doesn't have the zuma taken away from it. Or maybe dagim don't need it because they don't have the zuhama. And that's what Eliyahu Navi is going to answer for us, whether it is qualified to be used for tefillin or not. Shmuel Karno, Abiyatve Aguda Denar Malko. Shmuel and Karno, they were sitting on the banks of the river Malko in Bavel. Chazino de Mayo de Kadalu Vaakire. They saw that the water was rising and it was muddied or clouded or maybe even a little turbulent. Amalei Shmuel de Karno, so Shmuel says, based on these signs, there's a big gun that's coming from Eretz Yisrael. And he has a stomach ailment, or he's having problems with his digestive system. So the waters are rising to greet him as he's coming here. Zil go smell him out to find out what type of Talmud Chacham he is. Rashi over here explains this in a more metaphysical way, and that is that the waters should have been still because there was no wind that day. Despite the fact that there was no wind, there were waves or there was movement in the water, seemingly indicating that the water was rising or something was changing in the character of the water. And Shmuel saw that as a sign that somebody was coming from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel of significance, and therefore the waters were rising to greet him. It is somewhat connected to the Gemara that we saw back on Samach Hei Amud Bet, over there where the Gemara speaks about the machlok between Shmuel and Avuah de Shmuel and making the mikvot Over there at Rishonim, and the Gemara discusses about the waters coming from Eretz Yisrael, that the rise in waters in Eretz Yisrael caused a rise in the waters in Bavel. And so that's why Shmuel saw in the rise in the water must have been something that was coming from Eretz Yisrael, because that's the source of the water, or the rise of the water of the rivers in Bavel. And Tosafot discusses that in more detail back on Samachay Amud Bet. And then Shmuel, being a doctor, as we're going to see later on today's daf, knew that the turbulence or the mudding of the water was a sign that this person was having difficulty, and the waters were actually rising to protect him, as Rashi says over here, that the waters rose so that when he had to relieve himself over the side of the boat, people on the shoreline would not be able to see him because the waters had risen, and therefore it would create some sort of barrier or buffer between him and the shoreline. And so putting those pieces together, Shmuel figures out that there's a big gun coming. And he wants to know what type of big gun or how big this gun is that's coming from Eretz Yisrael. And therefore he sends out Karno to go and sniff him out. That's the terminology that's used here. Generally the Gemara uses the term bodik lei. Over here he uses tahi lei akankane, smell him, because Karno's job or Karno's profession was wine smelling. And so therefore he used the terminology that he was familiar with regards to his profession, in order to apply that to whoever was coming here to test them out. That's the way Rashi explains it. The Bali Tosafot bring a different gersa from the Beinu Chananel, and they have a much more rational explanation for this, which many of the Gaonim have a Mesora that this was the case, which was that Shmuel knew that somebody big was coming from Eretz Yisrael. That information he already had ahead of time, and therefore he wasn't guessing about the fact that the waters rising meant somebody big was coming. He knew somebody big was coming, but he saw the waters that were rising, and they were muddied waters, and he says, uh-oh, here's somebody coming from Eretz Yisrael, and he's definitely going to drink from the river water, and this water is not something that's familiar to his digestive system. It's going to cause him a stomach ailment. And so Shmuel knew for sure, since he's drinking from the river, that that's going to cause him digestive problems. That was caused by the fact that the waters were rising or churning, and that was causing him to be muddied, and therefore it wasn't clear water or pure water. And that was going to cause a problem for whoever was traveling up. And he sent out Karna to check out what was this level of this individual, because Shmuel was a doctor and he would provide services for him. So if he was a significant enough individual, Shmuel would take him home and treat him with a home visit to take care of him. So then he goes out, Azal Ashkeh the Rav. So he goes out and he finds that this is Rav. Rav, who was in Eretz Yisrael, who was a Talmid Muvak of Rabbi. So Karna went and he found that it was Rav, who was the big gadol that was coming. Rav actually descended from Eretz Yisrael twice. He was born in Bavel, went up with his uncle Rabbi Chia to Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Chia never came back. He learned by Rabbi eventually in Eretz Yisrael, becoming one of his Talmidim HaMuvhakim there in Eretz Yisrael. He returns at some point to Bavel for a short period of time to Narda, then goes back to Eretz Yisrael. And this seems to be the second time that he comes back to Bavel, where then he establishes himself and changes Bavel into a Torah center when he sets up the yeshiva and surah. This seems to be that second time that he came back. In that situation, Karna was sent out by Shmuel to see who was this big gun that Rav that was coming. Again, each one, depending on whether you think it's Rashi, that he didn't know it was Rav and he was trying to figure out who it was, or Shmuel already knew it was a big gun and wanted to know who or what type of big gun it was. How do you know the fact that you can only write tefillin on a kosher animal? Because the Torah of Hashem should be in your mouth. That which is mutar to put in your mouth, that is what you can use for the tefillin, because the parshiot of tefillin are mentioned there in Parshat Bo. How do you know that blood is red? Because it says, here is when there was an alliance between Israel, Yehuda, and Edom that were coming to attack Moab. And then Moab gets a mistaken impression because of the sun that was shining on the water that was coming, that there was some sort of breakdown in the alliance and that they had killed each other out. And Moab attacks thinking that there is nobody on the other side that's going to be able to fight them, and they are shocked to find that everything's still intact and it was an optical illusion that had tricked them. But you see over there that the waters were red, bloodied like dam. So you see that red is associated with dam, and both Rashi and Tosafot point out over here, even though the Mishnah Nido says that there are multiple colors that make dam into dam tmeah, they all are variations of red. For instance, the Gemara says with regards to black, that is blood that was red, elalaka, that something went wrong with it, there's something that caused it to go black, and same with the other colors that are mentioned in the Mishnah in Nida. How do you know that milah is performed on the male member? Nember kan urlato. Nember lahalan urlato. It says urlato by brit milah in parshat shmini. Biyom shmini mo masar urlato. And it says in parshat kiddushim, chitavo el aretz natatem kol eitz machal paraltem urlato et pirio. So you have urlato, urlato. Malahalan devasho se pri. Just like thereby it's speaking about a tree that is fruit producing. So too by the human being, it's the area or the organ that is reproductive. Emalibo. Why does it have to be his member? Maybe it is his heart. Because the pasuk in Parshat Ekev it says, that you will peel away the coverings or the thick skin that's around your hearts. Then it would seem to be that orla is associated with lave, and therefore mila would be the peeling away of that orla. Or ema ozno. Maybe it refers to his ear, because it says in the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, hine arela oznam, that their ears are thickened or deafen to what you're saying, and therefore also mila maybe means clearing up the ear or making it so that they can hear. So danin arlato tama mirlato tama, and vein danim arlato tama mirlato sheno tama. The word arlato in the Gzeir Shavir matches up exactly when you're using the noun arlato, not the noun phrase or the nismach of arlat levavchem or arela oznam, and you wouldn't cross reference arlato with either Orlat or Arela. Amrlei. So Rav realizes that Karna is testing him, trying to figure out who he is and whether he is worthy. Amrlei, Mashmech. Says, what's your name? So he answers back, Karna. Amrlei, Yehei Rava. Yehi Ratzon. Detipoklei Karna Be'enei. That he should have a horn in his eye. He was upset by the fact that Karna was testing him. He must have believed that Karna knew who was Rav was and he was just testing him, or that Rav thought that he was already well known in Bavel and therefore he figured that they would have known that he was a big gadol and they didn't need to test him. He was upset by the pretentiousness of Karna to come and test what he considers himself to be, the gadol ador. So if I lay the Shmuel the Beite, so then they brought him in to be by Shmuel, who is the gadol in Bavel before Rav arrives. Ochle, he as a doctor fed him Nama de Sare. He gave him barley bread, vikasa de harsana, and fish hash, which is this cut up fish with brine together, vashke shichra, and he gave him beer, probably date beer to drink, lachvalei beta kise, and he didn't let him or didn't show him where the bathroom was, keicha de lishtalil, in order that all these items, which are laxatives, then would clear out his system by him churning inside of him until it clears out his whole system, and finally show him the bathroom. Light rav vamar. Rav curses and says, "Man de mitzaran lo lukmahu le b'nei. Whoever is causing me all this difficulty should have no children." B'chein havu. And the Gemara says that's the way it was. Rav, the Gemara explains, in other places felt really bad of what he had done to Shmuel, and therefore he always gave kavod to Shmuel to go in front of him because he felt bad that this curse could, because of him, had caused this problem for Shmuel. The truth is that we do say in other stories throughout Shas that Shmuel had daughters. The question is whether those daughters were prior to this curse, and therefore when it says over here that lo lukmulo ben bani, that he have no children, it means children in general, but his daughters were already pre this curse. Or does it mean bani here means male children or male heirs? And he still had daughters afterwards, but he never had a male heir. And again, Rav felt bad about this. He didn't realize that Shmuel was doing it for his benefit, and therefore he cursed him despite the fact that it was for his benefit, and afterwards realizes that Shmuel was a doctor trying to help him out, but it's too late then because it's kishkaga sheyatza mipi ha-shalit. It was as if he had a slip of the tongue and a klala that comes from a Talmud Chacham, even though it's not justified, or even if it isn't really necessary, it still comes to fruition, and therefore the Gemara says v'chein habo that Rav's curse of Shmuel did come true. Kitanae, this whole issue about where's the source for the fact that the milah is done to the male member is actually machloket tanaim. Inayin the milah shiboto makom. How do I know that the milah is done on the male member? Nemar kan urlato. Erlalan urlato. Malalan davar shel sepri. Afkan davar shel sepri. Divrei Rabbi Yoshaya. So Rabbi Yoshaya says the same thing that divrei Rabbi Yoshia. So that's similar to what Rav had said. And now we have Rabbi Notan, who brings a different source for it. Rabbi Notan Omer, Eino Tzarich, you don't need that Gzeir Shava. Arei Omer, V'arel Zachar, Asher Lo Yimolet Besar Arloto. And Arel Zachar, who doesn't do a Brit Milah, is subject to the punishment of Karet. Makom Shnikar Ben Zichrut Denikvot. It's the area which is determinant as to whether the person is a male or a female. Meaning that that's where you recognize whether they're a male or a female. And that's what it says, V'arel Zachar, in the place of Zichrut, or identity as a Zachar, that's where the milah takes place. Tanu Rabbanan. Kotvin tefillin al gabe orbe matora. So again, as we saw earlier, that you can write tefillin on a kosher animal, babegor chayatora, or on a kosher wild animal, bagabe or nevelot betrefot shelahen. Not only is it true that you can use these animals when they are kosher, but even if they're not kosher, in particular, if they come from species that are kosher animals, that's okay. So you can use their nevelot or trefot of kosher animals. Venichrochot bisaran, you wrap up the parshiot with the hairs from these kosher animals. Venit parod begidin, and you stitch up the batim of the tefillin with the sinews of these kosher animals. Alacha the Moshe Misinai. It is Alacha Moshe Misinai Misora. This is not explicit in the Psukim. She tefillin nichrachot bisaran benitparot begidan. That they have to be wrapped in the hair of those kosher animals, and that they have to be stitched up. The gidim that are used to stitch up the batim come from these kosher animals. Aval en kodvim lo agabi or beimat mea, lo gabi or chayat mea. You can't use non-kosher animals in order to give you the cloth for tefillin, that we already learned from before, which the Gemara will repeat again. And certainly, those animals that are not kosher, if they were nevelot and trefot, then certainly you can't use them. You can't wrap them up, the parshiot, you can't tie them up with the hair from a non-kosher animal. And you can't stitch up the batim with sinews from these non-kosher animals. So this question was asked by one of the Baitusim. Baitusim were these a similar group to the Tzdukim that's mentioned in Avot in Rabbi Natan, that Tzadok and Baitus were the Talmidim of Antigonus Isocho, and went off the Derech because of his saying that we see in Mishnah Avot, which is explicated on in the Avot in Rabbi Natan, that out to Kavadim and Shamshim at the Rav Aminat the Kabbal Pras, the Kavadim and Shamshim at the Rav Shalom Aminat the Kabbal Pras. And they thought, if there's no reward, then what is this all about? And they were Porek all, and most of their issues were the Drashot of the Chachamim. They seemed to take the text of the Torah and Torah Shvaktav very literally. They didn't have a Torah Shvapeh, or they definitely did not subscribe to the Torah Shvapeh of the Chachamim. We've noted many other times that they still need a Torah Shvapeh because many of the terms in the Torah are undefined. And you see over here, there's some interaction between this Baitusi and Rabbi Yeshua Agarsi trying to understand exactly the halachot. If they wore tefillin, they needed some sort of misora as to how they made their tefillin and how their tefillin were put together. And so he's inquiring of someone of the Prushim who do have a Torah Shvapeh and do follow the Shita of the Chachamim, as to what the source is for all these laws that are associated with the tefillin. Minayin shein kotvin tefillin al or beimatmea. How do you know you can't use non-kosher animals to write tefillin on? Dichtiv, like we saw above, lamantia Torah Hashem beficha, that the Torah Hashem has to be able to go into your mouth. Idavara mutar beficha, something that is kosher to go into your mouth. Elameata agabe or nevelot betrevot ayichtuvu. So the bite to say yes, if it has to be kosher, it has to be something that you can put in your mouth, then nevelot and trevot, even from kosher animals, can't be eaten. Samarlei, so Rabbi Yoshua says back to him, sholacha mashal, I'll give you a parable. Lamadavar domeh. What is this similar to? The Shnei Bnei Adam Shnitchayvu Arigal Malchut. They both were subject to a death penalty to the king. Echad Arago HaMelech, one of them was killed personally by the king. Echad Arago Isplakitor, and one of them was killed by one of the messengers, one of the underlings of the king. Ezvei Mishubach, which one of them is better? Or which one would you consider to be of a higher authority or a higher consideration? There must be, Avi Omer, Zishar Ago Melech, must be the one that the king killed because he did it personally. It then elevates the status of that individual. Similarly, when it comes to an animal that's kasher because it was shechted, that was shechted b'bnei Adam. Those are the messengers or the underlings of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. The animal dies as a trefa or as a nevela, then it's killed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore it should have a higher status and an elevated status and be even more proper to use or even better to use for tefillin. So le'ata the Baitusi says to him, v'yachlu, why can't you eat them? Amalei ha-Torah amra lo tochlu kol nevela. The Torah explicitly says you can't eat a nevela. So yes, it might have a higher status because it was killed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu, but nevertheless, the Torah still restricts the eating of such an animal. And you say that they should be eaten? Doesn't make any sense. Amalei kalus. In Aramaic, kalos means to praise. Over here it seems to be it's the Greek version of the word. But praise be you that you gave a great explanation and you helped me understand this subject. The Baal Tosafot already point out that it's not such a great answer because there are many animals that die but at the hands of human beings that are considered to be nevelot. If it wasn't shechted, but it was killed in a different manner, that's also a nevela, and that's kosher to be used for tefillin, despite the fact that it wasn't killed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. What Tosafot points out is that once you see that nevelot and shreifot that are killed by Hashem are allowed to be used, that shows you that we don't take mitnuna mutar beficha so literally. And once we don't take it so literally, then we can expand it to include other items, even if they're not killed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah. It says, En osim helmei b'shabbat. You're not allowed to make this concentrated salt water solution on Shabbat. Salt water of that type of concentration was used in general for the processing of hides. So over here, you're not processing the hides, you're using it for food. And therefore, we worry about if you're using it for food, it might look like it is similar to ma'abed, tanning, the processing of items on Shabbat. There is a machloket earlier in the Masechta as to whether there's ibud by ochlim or any ibud by ochlim, but it seems to me that that machloket is only on a doraita level, is a Torah level argument. But midrabanan, everybody seems to agree that there is still a problem of ibud ochlim. That might be the sense of what we're going to get from this Mishnah as well as the remainder of the Gemara here. So the Rambam over here, to avoid that problem of the Machloket back on Ayin Hei Amud Bev with regards to Ibud Ochlim, explains that the problem over here is a problem of Bishul. And that we have in Hilchot Yoredeya, that Kavush is Harehu Kemivushal. That when you pickle something in a strong brine, and you leave it there over a duration of time, that has the same status as cooking, and therefore it's considered to be a preparation of food on Shabbat, as a derivative of Mevashel, according to the Rambam. And the Ritva adds on the possibility that maybe it's Uvdin Dechol. Looks like you're doing work that is normally done on a weekday. And that might be associated with the fact that the Malacha of doing this type of pickling or brine that was very strong was to create preservatives of the items. And those items that then are preserved are kept for a long duration. It's the equivalent to the Ramban's explanation of Malachet Avodah with regards to Yom Tov. What Malachot are allowed on Yom Tov, those are things that are immediately necessary for the day. Things that are for longer duration, or you do in large quantities, those are things that are considered Melechet Avodah, or even Asuot on Yom Tov. And similarly over here, maybe the problem, according to the Ritva, is that this is Uvdin Dechol. When you process items in this way, they're not for today to be used, they're not making them edible today or used today, they're for long-term storage, and therefore it's Uvdin Dechol that is not relevant or appropriate on Shabbat. But the Mishnah qualifies that and says, Avasehu mei melach betovel behen. You can make salt water and dip your bread in it. You can use it as a dip or as a salad dressing, and that's fine. Or you can add it into whatever you're cooking. Rabbi Yossi, valohu helmi ben miruba ben muat. Rabbi Yossi says, I don't understand. There should be no difference between how salty or how concentrated the item is. Either way, it's salt water. So it doesn't matter if it's heavily salted salt water or it's lightly salted salt water. There should be no difference between them. The Gemara asks, which direction is he going in? Elahein mei melach hamutarim. Which are the salt water that are mutar to be used? Notein shemen lechatchila. You put in oil first, either the tocha mayim or the tocha melach. You add oil to the salt, or you add oil to the water, and then you add the second ingredient. So if you did oil and water, you add the salt afterwards. If you did oil and salt, then you add the water afterwards. And that is because the shemen tempers the strength or the concentration of the melach, and it takes away from its potency. And so once you put in the oil, it takes away from the strength or the power of this brine or pickling that you've created. If you put the salt and water together first, you can't do that because then you already created the brine and then you're only mitigating it afterwards with the shemen. So you have to put the shemen with one of the ingredients first and then afterwards put in the other ingredient. Gemara says, Mai kamar. What is he saying? Meaning the Mishnah says there's mei melach and hilmi. What's the difference between the two of them? It's saying that hilmi is salt water that has a high concentration of salt. Mei melach has a low concentration of salt. One is impermissible on Shabbat, the other one is permitted on Shabbat. Why does it make a difference what the concentration is? Says there's no difference between them. Is he saying that they're both mutar, or are they both asur? Some Rabbi Yehuda l'atir. Must be that he's coming to be matir, midoloktani Rabbi Yossi oser. Because it doesn't say Rabbi Yossi thinks that it's asur. It says that Rabbi Yossi says there shouldn't be any differentiation between them. And since the Mishnah left off with the thing that is mutar, then you wouldn't have Rabbi Yossi say, Rabbi Yossi omer mutar, because he's then referencing back to something that the Chachamim agree is mutar. So if he contrasted it and said asur, then we would have known that it meant asur. Over here he doesn't do that, and he opts to say that if they're the same, that seems to indicate he thinks that they're both mutarim. So Amrlei, Rabbo, Amig, Bitani, Seifa. the seif ends off, these are the mei melach that are allowed to be used, meaning that seems to be a continuation of Rabbi Yossi's statement saying this is mutar. That means that what he was saying before means, I think that this is asur. Alam Rabba le'asur. Rabba says he came to be osir, to say there's no difference between high and low concentrated salt water. V'chenam Rabbi Yochanan le'asur. And Rabbi Yochanan agrees to similarly explanation that Rabbi Yossi here is coming to be osir. Tanya Nami Yochi, we have a braita that is supportive of that reading. Enosi me'melach merubim le'tei d'toch ha'vashim, shebetoch gistera. You're not allowed to make heavily salt concentrated brines that you put into the shards of pottery, because that's what they used to hold the pickling in. But you're allowed to make a low salt concentrated mixture. You can dip your bread into it, and you can add it to your cooking. Why? Just because one is highly concentrated, one is less concentrated, one should be asur, one should be mutar. Yomru melacham ruba asura melacha muetet mutaret. You're going to say now that if you do a big melacha, it's a problem. If you do a small melacha, it's not a problem. Why do you have gradations within a din or within a melacha? Ela elu veelu asurim, they're both problematic. Ve'elohen mei melacha mutarim. What are the salt water concentrations that are allowed? Notein shemen u'melach or shemen u'mayim. You make a mixture of either oil and salt or oil and water. Buvaj leiten mayim u'melach lechatchila. As long as you don't put the salt and the water in first, as long as you get the shemen in first, then that will mitigate or temper the concentration of the salt water, or the potency of the salt water. So Tani Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chaviva, Enosim Mei Melach Azim. You're not allowed to make very strong Mei Melach. My Mei Melach Azim. What does it mean, very strong Mei Melach? It seems to be here that the Gemara is following that this is the Psak, that the Chachamim's Shita is correct, and therefore the problem here is Hilmei. And the Gemara's question basically is, what does it mean that you have strong or concentrated salt water that is problematic? Rabbi Rabbi Yossi Ba'aba, the Amrei Tarvayu, they both say, Kol Hashav Beitzat Tzafabahen. If you submerge an egg into this salt water and it floats to the top, it's unable to sink in it, that's a concentration of salt already that's high enough to be considered a zin, and then it's problematic. Bekamo. How much is that? Give us some quantitative measure of what it is. Rabbi Yitzchak Tilte Milcha, 2/3 salt, Vitilta Maya, and 1/3 water. A mixture of 2/3 salt, 1/3 water, that's a high enough concentration where it's problematic. Lamai Abdullah, what do people use this type of highly concentrated salt water for? Amirbo, the Morisa, they use it for fish brine. Tanya Rav Yehuda Bar Chaviva, Ein Mochim Tznon U'Beitza B'Shabbat. You're not allowed to salt radishes and eggs on Shabbat. Rav Chizkiya Mishmei Dabai Amar, Tznon Asur, radishes are problematic, U'Beitza Muteret. Whereas an egg is fine. So Rashi over here explains that the problem over here is that if you do 3 or 4 slices together, so then the melach preserves them and they become hard. And that is a tikkun ochel, somewhat similar to what the Rambam says with regards to it being a toladav, tavshil, or derivative of tavshil. Rashi over here says that you're doing something, again, that involves a number of pieces. You're doing the tikkun on Shabbat, so you're doing something that's similar to ibud. And if we say that ibud ochlim is problematic, at least mit the Rabbanan, according to everyone, then that's problematic. Or you're doing some sort of thing, according to the Ritva, which has duration to it, because now you're preserving these items for long duration, and therefore it's problematic. So the first opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chaviva says that's problematic by Tznon and by Beitza, whereas Rabbi Chizkiya says that Tznon is problematic, but a Beitza is not problematic. And the reason for his differentiation is because people don't usually preserve eggs in this way, and this salt water is not so effective with regards to the beitza, and therefore it's not a problem with the beitza. I'm Rav Nachman Reish Abba Mechana Pugla. I used to salt my radishes, Amina of Sudei Ka Masidna Le, that it's actually detrimental to the radish when I salt them, so I'm not making a tikkun, I'm not improving them on Shabbat. I'm actually doing something that ruins them. Damar Shmuel, because Shmuel says, Pugla Chorfei Male, the more potent, the stronger the radish is, the better it is. So here, when the salt mitigates that potency, then it's detrimental. Came in the Shmana, the Ha, the Kiata Ula. After I heard this thing that when Ula came, Vamar, Bemarova, Malche, Kishre, Kishre, then in Eretz Yisrael, they salt circles and circles, or piles and piles of them. So you see that people do it, and people see that as an improvement. Not necessarily on Shabbat they were doing it, but the fact that they did it in general shows you that they see that as a tikkun. Mimalach lo mechano. I stopped salting them on Shabbat, tvulei vade matbilina, but I still dipped them into salt water or into salt on Shabbat, because that wasn't making them into preservative, that was just for flavor, and that's not a problem. Tani, Rabbi Yehuda bar Chaviva, etrog tznonu beitza, with these three food items, yomalei klipatan, my chitzunot, they did not have an outer layer, and on yotzim b'mei ma'ayim le'olam, they would not leave your digestive tract forever. And that is because they would harden because of the digestive system and they would never be released. So their outer klipa protects that from happening. So by an etrog and a tznon, it's understandable. One of them has a skin around it. The tznon has the radish has a thin red layer around it. Beitza has a shell around it. And Rashi points out here that you can't be speaking about the shell because that's not something that's edible. But rather it's speaking about the albumin, the white of the egg that's around it, that surrounds the yolk, and that makes it that the yolk is digestible when the white goes in around it. And that's why it's being suggested over here. Otherwise, the digestive system will cause the hardening of them, similarly to what we saw with the salty water that causes a hardening of these items when they're preserved in very concentrated salt water. The Dead Sea has this feature to it that nobody ever drowns in the Dead Sea. When the Romans came and invaded and they conquered the Jewish armies, they were curious about the Dead Sea, and there are stories brought in Josephus where they used to take out Jewish captives into the Dead Sea and throw them into the water. They didn't know how to swim, but they never drowned, and they were shocked or surprised or amazed by that which they saw. So we know that there is this feature about the Dead Sea, that everybody floats in the Dead Sea. Samar Rav Yosef, hafucha sodom, hafucha mila. He says, stone was overturned, and this statement of Rav Dimi seems to be upside down or problematic. Gavrahu de lo tava, kashura tava. You're going to tell me people don't sink in the Dead Sea, but a board of wood would sink in the sea or other items would sink in that Dead Sea? He's saying not only, lo mi bayi kashura, you don't have to ask me about a board that it won't sink in the Dead Sea. Dafila b'chol meimot shebolam. In any ocean or any saltwater body, it would not sink. Lo tava. So of course in the Dead Sea it doesn't sink. Ela afilu gavra, the tava b'chol meimot shebolam. When it comes to individuals and any other salt water body, they would sink and they would drown. Beyond the stone, lo tova. When it comes to the Dead Sea, they do not drown. L'may nafkamina. What's the halachic ramification of this? God the Ravin. It's because of what Ravin teaches us. He was trailing after, walking after Rabbi Yirmiyah, Aguda, the Yam of the Stone, on the banks of the Dead Sea. Can I take some of that water and put it in my eye on Shabbat? So it seems to me that it had some sort of medicinal quality, which is interesting because the Gemara in other places says that Melach Stomit, the salt from the Dead Sea, can blind one, and therefore you have to wash Mayim Achronim. Over here now you're putting the salt water from the Dead Sea into the eye, and it's medicinally curative. So it must be there's a difference between the salt and the salt water. Amalei shapredami. You're allowed to do that on Shabbat. It's not any violation of gauging in medicinal cures on Shabbat because it just looks like you're washing out your eye. Ma'ul the meimatz lemiftach. What about closing my eye tightly and opening it up in order to wash it around and to make it work? Amalei zulo shamati. I didn't hear anything directly about this. Kiyotze ba shamati. But I did hear something similar that should answer the question. Sometimes he said it over in the name of Marukva. Sometimes he said it over in the name of Rav Matna. And both of them, and both of them said it over in the name of either Avu Shmuel or Levi. There are two items here. And each one of them said one of these two items, Avu Shmuel and Levi. You're allowed to put wine on the surface of the eye. You're not allowed to put wine into the eye. It's the equivalent of what we were saying over here, which is that you're allowed to wash out your eyes with wine, similar to the way that you wash it with water. People wouldn't think anything of that. People who are healthy do such a thing, and therefore it's not problematic at all because you're acting like a healthy person and it doesn't look like you're practicing medicine. On the other hand, if you put it into the eye, meaning that you open and close and you do a lot of things to force the wine into the eye, then that would be problematic because then you're behaving in a manner that indicates you're doing it for medicinal purposes. It seems to be that the wine, the alcohol in the wine, was beneficial to the eye or cleansing out the eye, and therefore people washed with it. The other, v'chadamar, rok tafel, when it comes to saliva that has yet to taste any food in the morning, afila gava ayin asur, even on the surface of the eye is problematic because the only people who put saliva into the eye, maybe because of the acidic concentrations in it that are helpful, that is problematic because nobody does that unless they're doing it for medicinal purposes, and practicing medicine or engaging in things that are medicinal on Shabbat is problematic because of shkikat smananim. We're afraid that you're going to grind up the medicines or grind up medicine on Shabbat. Tistayim, let us conclude, Avua Deshmo, Damar Yayim Etoch Ayin Asur, Al Gabi Ayin Mutar. Let us conclude that that's the statement of Avua Deshmo, Midamar Shmo. Because we have a statement from Shmo, Shore Adam Pito B'Yayin, person how to soak his bread in wine, V'Nodno Agav Ayin, B'Shabbat, and he puts it on top of his eye on Shabbat. So again, that would be something that's considered to be normal practices, even of healthy people. And it seems to be only Al Gav Ayin, on the surface of the eye is okay. That doesn't say you could put it into the eye, Deshmele Miman. Where did he get that Mesorah from? Love the Shmuel Mavua, must have heard it from his father. So it must be that Shmuel got that from his father, Avua the Shmuel. Belitamech, according to your reasoning, Adam HaShmuel, Rok Tafel, Afilu Agav Ayin Asur, that when it comes to Rok Tafel, you're not allowed to put it even on the surface of the eye. That's also said by Shmuel, the Shmuel Miman. Who did he hear that from? Yilema the Shmuel Mavua, if he heard it from his father, El Levi Lo Kadamar. Now you're leaving Levi without attribution for either one of these statements, because Shmuel based both of them. And if Shmuel got it from his father, then Levi's left out of this. It must be that Shmuel heard one of them from his father, one of them from Levi, and we don't know which one came from which individual. Therefore, that's the answer to the question that he asked. Yes, you're allowed to put the salt water from the Dead Sea on your eye like a rinse and rinse out your eye. That's fine. But if you're going to open and close your eye and force the water into your eye using it in a medicinal manner, that would be problematic, similar to what we said by the wine. Just like by the wine, you can put it on the surface of the eye or wash out the eye like other people would do or healthy people would do. What you can't do is do it in a manner that only if somebody had an eye ailment or somebody was using it medicinally would have done. Some of my Ukva Mashmol, Shure Adam Kilorin, Me Erev Shabbat, Notein Al Gabe Enav B'Shabbat. Person's allowed to soak kolorium, which was an eye salve, me erev Shabbat, before Shabbat, notein al gabe enav b'Shabbat. And one is allowed to put it on their eye on Shabbat, menu chushesh, and don't have to worry about it. Barli vai, havakai kamei de marukva. He was learning or present in front of marukva. Chazit gabe mayitz upotach. He saw that he had put the kolorium in his eye, but he was making efforts to squeeze his eye, open his eye, to move it around in a medicinal manner. Amalei kulei hai vadei lo shara mar Shmuel. Shmuel only allowed you to put it in like a normal person would put it in, to use it in a way that is medicinal in nature, that you can't do. To make all that effort to spread it around, that's already too much, and even Shmuel would agree that you can't do that. Shalach lei Rabbi Yanai the Marukva. Rabbi Yanai sent to Marukva, who seems to be that he was close with Shmuel, and he spent a lot of time with them. Lishtavan mar, mehana kilorin de mar Shmuel. Send us some of that great kolorim of mar Shmuel to help out with our eyes. I'm definitely going to send it to you. So say that I'm not a miserly individual and I'm not generous. I'm going to send it to you, but you don't really need it. If you wash out with cold water in the morning, and you wash your hands and feet with hot water at night, it does better or it's more efficacious than all of the kilorin that you have in the world. And you have a brayta that supports that contention. A rinse of cold water in the morning and rechitzat yadayim raglayim arvit in chamin is better mikol kilorin shvolam than any kolorim or any eye salve that you can get in the world. Meaning that you don't need it. I'll send it to you, but you don't really need it. There's a better solution that is a simple, natural solution, then you don't need this kolorim. What's interesting about this Gemara is that the Baalei Tosafot, as Rabbi Akiva Eger points out, back on Daf Yud Chet Amud Aleph, quote this Gemara, and are a little surprised by this Gemara based on what we saw back on Daf Yud Chet Amud Aleph, which is that you're allowed to put something on Erev Shabbat and let it go and be curative throughout Shabbat, but you can't put it on Shabbat itself. Yet our Gemara seems to indicate that you could even put it on Shabbat. As long as you prepared it before Shabbat, you could put it on your eye even on Shabbat. So what's the difference? Why over there on Daf Yud Chet we don't let you put it on Shabbat, only Erev Shabbat? Over here we let you put it on Shabbat. So Tosafot differentiates between our Gemara that's speaking about a Bari, a healthy individual, and therefore he's not putting it on for medicinal purposes, but he's putting it on to give some sort of pleasure or gives a nice feeling towards his eye or maybe even improves his eye, but it's not something where he's ailing in any way. Whereas the Gemara on Daf Yud Chet, which says you must put on before Shabbat and not on Shabbat itself, is an individual who already has an eye ailment and therefore he's trying to use it outright for refuah. There you need to put on before Shabbat, you can't put on Shabbat itself. That's the answer of the Baalei Tosafot. Tosafot Yeshanim over there gives an alternate answer. Hotam enu mesim kilor atzmo b'tachboshet. Over there he's not putting it on a bandage with the kolorim on the bandage. Over there he soaked it in water. So when it's soaked in water, it looks more like a regular rinse, so that it looks like he's just washing out his eyes. So first of all, he's not going to get confused because he soaked it in water. Other people are not going to get confused because they just see him washing with water. They don't know there's kolorim in it. And that's why over there you can do it on Shabbat. Over here, where it's on a bandage, and it's the solid chlorine that you're putting on, it's clear that he's doing it for medicinal purposes. So both the individual doing it is going to think you can perform medicine or you can crush up medicine on Shabbat, as well as other people seeing him are not going to think he's doing this in a natural way. He's just doing this like other people would do this. He's definitely doing it for medicinal purposes, but they also would get the wrong impression. And that's how Tosafot Yeshanim differentiates between the Gemara back on Yud Chet and the Gemara on Kuf Chet Amud Bet. And we're going to stop here, two lines from the bottom of Kuf Chet Amud Bet.